how many false announcements there were going into the weekend about Pope John Paul II. Everyone knew that his health was failing. That was obvious. I was on the internet, and I think I came across three announcements before he died that he had died. And, of course, all of them were in time corrected. And then, finally, when the announcement did come that he had died, Pope John Paul II, and there was no doubt about it, it had been verified through the Vatican, a certain sense of finality sets in. And then wonder about both retrospectively and prospectively. Looking back, a wonder at 26 years, a long, very long pontificate, and a life, an amazing life. The kind of life that you couldn't write if you were going to be writing it as fiction. Pope John Paul II. And then what lies ahead? Well, here in the first 90 minutes of Issues Etc., we're going to deal with the death of Pope John Paul II from three different perspectives, beginning with Uwe Simonetto, religious affairs editor for UPI. We're going to be talking to him, getting a journalist's perspective on Pope John Paul II. That will be followed by Dr. James Hitchcock in the second half hour of the program, and historical perspective on the death of the Pope. And then finally, and most importantly, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn will join us for a theological perspective on Pope John Paul II. That'll be the first half of the program today, followed by a half-hour conversation with Dr. William Tye. He's of Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He has written an article for Touchstone titled Abusing the Fathers. The Windsor Report was a report that came out from the Anglican Communion some time back, just about a month and a half back. And this report was dealing with the whole ordination of active homosexuals in the Episcopal Church USA. That report cited the Nicene Council, way back 325, the Nicene Council saying that, you know, these Orthodox Anglican bishops can't be meddling around in the Episcopal Church USA. They shouldn't be doing that, no matter how bad things are in the Episcopal Church USA. We'll find out whether or not those claims to that council are true when we talk with William Tye there at 4:30. Then in the 5 o'clock hour, the beginning of a four-part series on the book of Hebrews, Dr. Harold Tomisch will join us from Concordia University, Wisconsin. And that's today's Issues Etc. lineup. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We begin three perspectives on the death of Pope John Paul II with Uwe Simonetto, religious affairs editor for United Press International. Uwe, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
You have written, actually at the death here of Pope John Paul II, that he was your pope, and yet you assert there in the first paragraph that you haven't converted. What do you mean by this?
Well, I'm obviously still a Protestant in many, many ways, but this particular pope, this one, spoke for me. He formulated to the universe, to people around the world, my faith. Now, there were differences. Obviously, he didn't formulate it from a Lutheran perspective, but he did formulate the gospel. He brought the gospel to everybody. He, in my lifetime, and I'm 68, in my lifetime, he is the one pastor who has spoken to the entire world about something that has been ridiculed, that's been persecuted in my lifetime, in both in Nazi Germany and in communist Germany, for example, and is being persecuted even now increasingly in the Western world because it's no longer chic. He is a guy who had the amazing charisma to assemble around him, even as he lay dying, tens of thousands of young people. He appealed to the young. He stilled their hunger for the gospel, and he stilled their hunger for God. He addressed that hunger, at least. And in that sense, obviously, he spoke for me. He spoke for me in his total commitment to life, and the life in Christ, as opposed to death, which has become so fashionable, as we've seen in the Terry Schiavo case, as we've seen with 41 million abortions since Roe v. Wade in this country. He did what every pastor should do of any denomination, insisting that our religion, namely the Christian religion, is one of life. And that was received, and especially young people received it. And for that, I identify with him, obviously.
Now, I've heard a lot of evaluations in the last 24, 48 hours following his death and nearing his death. And one thing, one thread has come through in the journalist's perspective on this, and that is, well, you know, this Pope coming shortly after the close of Vatican II was an anachronism. He was kind of a pre-Vatican II Pope in a post-Vatican II church. Would you agree with that?
Well, in a sense, he was and he wasn't. He was an he obviously, to many journalists who have no idea what Christianity is about, anybody who formulates Orthodox Christianity, Orthodox Christian theology, is an anachronism. You know, he doesn't affirm homosexual sex, that he doesn't affirm abortion. All these things seem anachronistic. In that sense, yes, the Pope did that. Secondly, that this Pope has the Pope has reversed, or has been trying to reverse, some of the ludicrous deviations from Vatican II, like, for example, the absurd liturgies that you sometimes experience in Roman Catholic churches, not dissimilar from absurd liturgies you might find in certain Protestant churches. In that sense, yes, he was an anachronism. But in reality, what he did was he took Vatican II and what the essence of Vatican II, which was gospel-centered, and brought this to the world. And so, therefore, he was faithful to Vatican II.
As a Lutheran, where would you disagree with Pope John Paul II? Can you point to an incident or two in his pontificate where you say, okay, in this case, he's not speaking for me?
Well, the evident incident for was when he when this Turk Aksa tried to assassinate him in 1981, and Pope John Paul, being very much a Polish Catholic and therefore a Marianic Catholic, credited the Virgin Mary with saving his life. Now, of course, this is where I say, well, fine, he's the Pope after all, and I'm a Lutheran, and we have to not part company, but I would say his life was saved by God and not by the Virgin Mary. Not that we Lutherans do not venerate the Virgin Mary, but, I mean, she has, to at least in our theological mind, doesn't have that function that she can save a man's life. It's the will of God. That is the primary thing. There are other things, obviously, that have to do with the traditions of the Church, the heavy emphasis that we lay on the sola scriptura principle, that in Scripture alone truth is revealed. Well, he would have agreed with that, but then, of course, as Roman Catholics do, he said, well, yeah, but then there are the traditions. Here, one can argue, obviously. But I think that is the most important issue would be this Marianic thing.
Let's deal with him as a geopolitical figure, really, almost from the very outset at his election,
right,
cast upon the global stage, not just European, not just Western, but the global stage. First of all, in the context of the death of communism. Talk about that.
Well, I agree with those. Having lived this period and having been like this Pope through communism, and I've lived in communist East Germany and before that in Nazi Germany, I agree with those who say that this Pope has had the major share in the downfall of communism by obviously supporting trade union movement in his own country, by upholding Orthodox faith in his own country. He was together, I would say, with Ronald Reagan and to some extent Gorbachev. He was instrumental, and I think he was a gift from God in this historical in these historical circumstances. The interesting thing is, of course, we are all pretty certain that it was communism that tried to kill him in 1981 via Mr. Aksa. But the interesting thing is also that the communists, that the left sort of thought, well, you know, here is this right winger, or here is this mega conservative. But in reality, he's of course not a mega conservative. He was a conservative Christian, but he was, as you know, as often as critical of the extreme forms of capitalism, the me-first type of capitalism, as he was of communism. In his attack on the culture of death, obviously, he included this, what he saw as an American obsession with capital punishment. The man was actually if you look at it from a distant perspective, he was fairly balanced in both scores, but clearly he was instrumental in bringing down communism.
I heard one person, this was long before he died, refer to John Paul II as the Flying Pope, because he spent as much time traveling the world as any other head of state. In fact, one might argue far more than most heads of state. Talk about his great travels and the purpose of all of that.
Well, he was the Flying Pope because he was clearly an apostle to the world. He went to 130 countries. He spoke God knows how many languages, and some of them very competently. He made sure that people at all corners of the world understood that from the Christian point of view, they were all God's children and equal in God's love. And in that sense, this Pope was fantastic. We also have to say, and that is, of course, might lead into the next discussion here, by flying around and by bringing the gospel to the entire globe, he also neglected, of course, running the shop back in Rome. And there are problems there because as he was flying about, you had all sorts of sectarian developments within the Vatican that are troublesome and that have to be rectified.
And while that is, I think, probably another common observation, that he was not the most attentive administrator to Vatican business, yet at the same time, I think of the College of Cardinals now, he appointed the vast majority of these men, and I think of the 113 that are going to vote on his successor, easily appointed, 80-85% of the cardinals.
Right.
So he seems to have set the course for the future, at least in the terms of the papacy, of the Roman Catholic Church for some time.
Yes, but he has appointed also, very interestingly, if you look at my home country, Germany, he's also appointed liberals to be cardinals. Take Cardinal Kasper, who is in charge of the Congregation for Christian Unity, who is considered to be fairly liberal. Cardinal Lehmann, who is the chairman of the German Bishops' Conference, is liberal. You still have in South America a division between the liberals and the and the conservatives, and they might actually neutralize each other in the conclave, and might actually prevent a South American from being elected because they're so. It is true that also, you know, you never know. A guy might be orthodox and sound orthodox, and then turn out once he ascends to the throne of St. Peter, he might turn out to be a raving liberal. You never know.
Do you find yourself in a strange position, Uwe, of defending this pope and his many deeds and works against many Western Roman Catholics who might blatantly say, he didn't speak for me?
Yes, well, absolutely. I've had this the whole time. Hey, you're more Catholic than us. Or even my Catholic friends who are conservative Catholics say, well, hey, you're more like us. Yes, I said, in 90% of the cases, a good Lutheran and a faithful Lutheran is a brother Christian to you, and whereas others who may hop to church every Sunday and then go and have an abortion the next day may feel quite differently about certain things. Certainly on the key issues, on which I agree with the Pope, I may disagree violently with liberal Catholics. And that is, and these issues are that Christ is the only mediator, and in Christ lies the only salvation. It is on issues that are called social issues, but which are, of course, the essential ethical issues, such as the sanctity of life, such as the such as marriage. All right, so to us, marriage is not a sacrament, but it's nonetheless an order of creation. So it comes from God. And here you have in this country alone, which is outrageous, you have these bishops dissolving marriages left, right, and center. You have about 40,000 disillusions of Catholic marriages in this country. So, I mean, they're behaving as moronically as many of the Protestants. So in that sense, yes, I defended the Pope's position vis-a-vis poseurs who think they're Roman Catholics, but actually are liberal Protestants.
That conclave that assembles here within about 2 weeks to begin voting of cardinals, to begin voting for the successor to John Paul II, I've heard the news lately where they're saying, well, look, the problem here is that the Western, in particular the American Catholics, are not going to be fairly represented there. They're on the progressive edge, and yet if you look at the numbers, Uwe, even with 65 million Catholics, that's less than 6% of the entire Catholic communion.
Yes, it's tiny, and what's more, the American Catholic, as we noted, are divided among liberals and Orthodox. Moreover, you have Catholics in this country. Some of the Catholic cardinals are on a part of the Italian faction because they are of Italian origin and they want an Italian back on the throne in a see of Rome, as Bishop of Rome, whereas others would be more inclined to have, say, a black cardinal like Arinze elected from Nigeria, elected as Pope, and yet others who are Orthodox who would like to see people like Ratzinger, the German cardinal, as Pope. So the Americans are as split as the South Americans are broken up, and you have this split running straight through all the provinces of the Church. You have this in Europe, of course. You have the liberals versus the Orthodox. And it's all very, very similar. But it is clear that the United States has a very, very limited influence on it, not only because they only make up 6%, but also because they've had this major sex scandal here in this church, and because the church is so divided. I mean, just look at the hysterical nuns running around this country who I wonder why they're nuns, you know, or why they're actually in the service of the church, and who have a very heavy influence on certain parts of the Roman Catholic Church in this country.
What about, you talked about communism, what about, and this dovetails nicely with the discussion of the West, the postmodern mindset that now infects much of religious thinking.
Right.
Did the Pope ever divest himself of any ideas there for the Church on postmodernism in particular?
Oh, no. Well, look, all his, I think everything, every encyclical that I have read so far was in opposition against the postmodern idea of multiple truths. I mean, that's what postmodern is all about, that, you know, you can choose your truth, I choose my truth, and Jack over there chooses his truth. There's one truth, and that was the main thrust of his ministry, and he made it very, very clear that this one truth lies in the gospel. And in that sense, he was indeed a countercultural pope, because he resisted postmodernism, and the entire culture of death that he castigated so much is, of course, postmodern. I would predict that if future historians look back at this particular period in history, they'll say, well, it's very funny this countercultural pope has survived postmodernity very, very easily.
You write that while he is an endearing figure, without a doubt,
yeah,
this pope has not been cuddly. What do you mean?
Well, no, he called a spade a spade. You know, he was he said some very, very uncomfortable things. He castigated his own priests and his own bishops to toe the line. My wife made a wonderful observation. My wife, who is Anglican, made a very funny, lovely observation during one of the recent sort of perplexed commentaries on television about this pope, that he was, of course, a very nice man. However, of course, he was not dearly beloved by everybody, and his views were not loved by everybody. And then she just simply says, well, the problem with this pope was he knew right from wrong. And so therefore, and there are lots of people who don't like people who know right from wrong, but he knew right from wrong.
Finally, Uwe, with only about a minute here, yeah, a comment from a journalist's perspective on how Pope John Paul II's life ended, and there is speculation already about endowing him in death with a title, Pope John Paul the Great, which goes to very few popes in Catholic history.
Well, I would also call him the Great, and I think his death, the dignity, the courage with which he died, the fact that the guy signed on his deathbed signed the nominations for 17 bishops and archbishops, that he showed to the rest of the world that life was worth living until the very moment God calls you home. This, at the following a couple of days, this horrible death of Terry Schiavo, who is to me a victim of postmodern postmodern murder. And here is this guy who, on his deathbed, showed the worth of every life until it's taken away from you. I think that he will be probably most remembered for that. He's glorious.
Uwe Simonetto is religious affairs editor for United Press International. Uwe, we always appreciate your perspective, and thank you for bringing us this journalist perspective on the death of Pope John Paul II.
Thank you, Todd.
Uwe Simonetto. When we come back from this break, more discussion post posthumously of Pope John Paul II. Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University, where he serves as professor of history, will join us for an historical perspective on Pope John Paul II. Then we'll round off the first half of the program with Dr. Ron Feuerhahn. We'll get a theological perspective on Pope John Paul II. Dr. Feuerhahn is associate professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Now, in the second half of the program, Dr. William Tighe will join us. The Episcopal Church USA has been up to its shenanigans. The Anglican Communion gently, very gently, almost with kid gloves, rebuked the Episcopal Church USA in a report called the Windsor Report. That report made reference to the Council of Nicaea back in 325. We'll find out whether or not it was a right citation of that ancient church council as it castigated some more conservative elements of the Anglican Communion. And then, in the third hour, part one of our four-part series on the Book of Hebrews with Dr. Harold Tomisch. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Sound Christian theology is supposed to be learned, believed, and lived. Sound Christian theology is also supposed to be prayed. Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April is a resource for your daily devotion in God's Word, a way to daily pray the theology that you have learned, believed, and live. It's called The Lord Will Answer, a Daily Prayer Catechism. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look on the home page. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Lord Will Answer, a Daily Prayer Catechism, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. The Lord Will Answer, a Daily Prayer Catechism.
Is your church youth group on a steady diet of entertaining events, but always clamoring for more? This Global Minute warns many kids may leave for another church when they become dissatisfied. Founder of Spectrum Ministries, Pastor Vaughn, found a strategy when he pastored 500 to 600 kids that kept them coming back.
If it's youth and you got a fun and games program that's brought these kids in, if the church down the street gets a better program, they're leaving. But I tell you something, if it's ministry and missions that have brought the kids into your church, you got no competition at all. They're going to stick. I know, because it happened to my church.
To learn the strategy instrumental in many of those kids' decisions to go on the mission field with a commitment to God's global cause, call 1-800-268-0461 and ask for the free CD with Pastor Vaughn's interview. 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Monday morning is tough enough without a time change. According to Michael Downing in his new book, Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time, it was an Englishman, William Willett, who first promoted this change in 1907 so people could exercise more in the evening. In 1966, Congress encouraged daylight saving time for all the United States. Today, only Hawaii, Arizona, and most of Indiana don't change their clocks. We've lost an hour. We talk about time as a commodity, a thing. I'm running short on time. Can you spare me a minute? Time is a thing. The Bible talks about time more as a place. The first commandment tells us to have no false god in our heart. The second or third commandment, depending on how you number them, says to revere God with our lips, heart, lips. What's next? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. That is, after heart and lips, worship God in time. Time is not so much a thing, it is a place of worship. We all have the same amount of time each day. On Monday or any day, try looking at time as a place, your cathedral of thanks and service to God. That might just ease the madness of squeezing more and more into less and less time.
On Tuesday's Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. Well, the temperatures are warmer, we're on daylight savings time, and we're thinking baseball, and we're going to have Chuck Rathert in studio to talk baseball with us on the next Living Jubilee. Also, Susan May Warren, the name to watch in romantic suspense, talks about Flee the Night, her latest book, on the next Living Jubilee.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live. It's the fourth day already of April, this Monday on the program. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April is The Lord Will Answer, a Daily Prayer Catechism. Now you say, I thought a catechism was one of those books that has questions and answers about the Christian faith in it. Yes, indeed. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer, follows the form of the catechism, those six chief parts that are common to so many catechisms. The Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, Scripture's teaching on baptism, absolution, the Lord's Supper. It follows that form in a day-to-day format, a theology that you can pray. And that's what it's aimed toward, personal and family devotions. Each page, a section, a small section of the catechism for contemplation and for meditation and for devotion. It's $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Very useful. The kind of thing you'll carry around with you along with your Bible. Useful for your daily devotions. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. You've got 90 minutes to do so today. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. I'll tell you, folks, there was a book like this that was written about 50 years ago that I used as a parish pastor. The problem was it was not accessible necessarily to lay people. This one is. The Lord Will Answer, $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Or for more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. And on the homepage, you'll find more about the Issues Etc. book of the month for April, The Lord Will Answer, a Daily Prayer Catechism. We're continuing our discussion posthumously of Pope John Paul II. Now, an historical perspective with Dr. James Hitchcock, a regular guest here on the program and professor of history at St. Louis University. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back.
Thank you.
You're an historian 100 years from now. How significant will the tenure of John Paul II be in history?
I think we don't know for sure what his long-term effect is going to be. He leaves behind an enormous mass of writing. I think he's one of the most important Christian thinkers of the 20th century. To the degree, it's going to take a long time to digest all of that, and to what extent it will affect later generations of scholars, theologians, philosophers, that will depend partly then on in the answer to your question. He certainly has also elevated the papal office to a visibility that it has never had before, and his own personal charism has, of course, made him not only the most widely known pope, but I suppose the most popularly acclaimed pope in the history of the Church. He has encouraged various what he sees as hopeful movements of renewal and revigoration in the Church. It will depend, again, on what happens in the next 100 years, whether these really bear fruit or not. So I think in some sense it's an open question.
Has he set the, at least in terms of a legacy, has he set the course for the Church, at least institutionally, by the fact that he has been around long enough to outlive most of the people who would have succeeded him and had the opportunity, as we said in the last segment, to appoint the better portion of those who will choose his successor?
I think that paradoxically, less so institutionally than he has been done intellectually, perhaps, and spiritually. It's a misapprehension, as some people argue, that he's basically just appointed cardinals and bishops very much like himself. I think that there's quite a variety. There's a considerable spectrum of positions, even within the papal curia itself. You've got cardinals disagreeing with one another. And I think that's the aspect of his pontificate to which he has given the least amount of attention. And therefore, you cannot say that he has institutionalized his ideas and his teachings.
I want to talk a bit about at least a few of those 14 encyclicals that are the product of his pontificate. But first of all, more popularly, in 1995-96, there was the publication of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, intended for lay people, intended for daily use in the Church. How significant is that document?
Well, potentially it is. I would say that probably had less to do with the Pope himself than it did perhaps with Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, and it's a good illustration because a lot of the things of this nature which have been done by his subordinates. The Catechism is a marvelous document, but on the other hand, it has not been universally applied. It is not really the working basis of Catholic education in many places, and there has not been as yet a serious effort to make it so. So I think that's a good example of the kind of uncertainty of his legacy.
And of his more formal work, which is, would you say, in time will be deemed the most significant of his encyclicals?
Well, I would have a hard time singling out a particular one. The themes that run, of course, through all of them have to do with the true humanism. I've often said that John Paul is the true humanist of our time, that the dignity of man is only in the light of his Creator. John Paul has affirmed in the most eloquent way the inherent dignity of humanity, the creative responsibilities which God has given to the human race, the responsible use of freedom, the fact that our glory is dependent entirely, of course, upon our acknowledgement of our Creator. I think a very good illustration of this in sort of bottom line terms is the very term humanism is becoming problematical because if you use it, people will say, what's the matter? Are you claiming to be superior to the animals? And I think that a real humanism in the traditional sense now depends upon religious belief. And I think John Paul has expressed that more eloquently and more sweepingly than just about anybody in our time.
At various times, Dr. Hitchcock, especially going farther back in Catholic history, popes were very significant political entities. In fact, one might argue at certain points, more significant than the most powerful political men, at least in Europe, of their day.
That's correct.
Did Pope? But then there was a time in which that shifted, and the Pope became largely less political. But did John Paul recapture some of that, at least by way of influence through his many travels and things like that?
It would depend, I guess, on what you mean by political. The popes of the 20th century, certainly as far back as Benedict XV at the time of the First World War, tried to play some role in international affairs. They didn't always succeed. Then, of course, the popes came out of the Vatican, as it were, beginning with John the 23rd in 1958. The pope was not political, I think, in the sense of somebody who was probably engaged in a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiating and maneuvering. We may not know that for many years either until various archives are opened. But he was political in the sense that he was extremely interested in these kinds of questions. I think he provided the spiritual inspiration and leadership which helped to lead to the fall of communism. I think he articulated a highly positive vision of what politics should be all about. And he would be willing to criticize Western democracy and capitalism as well as to criticize. But I don't think he was political in the more active sense.
What was John Paul's relationship to Vatican II, not so much as a council itself, but to its aftermath in many ways, especially in the Western church, kind of saying, okay, all bets are off. Vatican II opened the windows.
Right.
We're going to knock down the walls. What was his relationship to that use of Vatican II?
Well, you know, the issue there, which is, it would take weeks to go through, I like to compare it to the American Constitution. That is, people debate continuously, what did the Founding Fathers mean? And that is going on all the time in the Catholic Church. What was Vatican II all about? He was a very active participant in the Second Vatican Council. In my judgment, he was imbued with its spirit, particularly a certain spirit of, I think he was an indomitable optimist. One of the key documents of the council called Gaudium et Spes, Joy and Hope. He was, I think, an indomitable optimist. And I think he saw that as, in a certain sense, one of the messages of the council, a new Pentecost, the revivification of the spiritual life, the turning to the gospel. He was so much so, I think, that he tended probably to minimize the seriousness of some problems. He will be accused by his critics of being a reactionary, of having undermined Vatican II, but that's only because of certain contentious interpretations of what Vatican II was supposed to mean. The crucial issue, I think, for the Pope in every case is the same, responsible use of freedom. So Vatican II was a proclamation of freedom, but real freedom only when it's used responsibly.
Another significant document that came out of Vatican II had to do with the nature of the church and the interrelationship between the scattered brethren of the church, Lumen Gentium, a light to the Gentiles. Talk about this pope as an ecumenical figure.
Well, he certainly was that, and he's been criticized here sometimes by conservative Catholics. There have been some gatherings, there were two at Assisi, for example, where there was seemingly some mixed signals being sent as to whether we're suddenly putting ourselves on the same plane as Buddhists and Hindus. I think that was not something the Pope intended. His priority pretty clearly seems to have been openness to the Eastern Orthodox, hoping perhaps that with the fall of communism some reconciliation could take place. I don't think at this point there's any serious possibility of that happening, but he could have planted some long-range seeds. The problem here, again, it's not so much Christian ecumenism, which we're very used to, of course, in the last 40 years or so, but the larger ecumenism of non-Christian religions, and that creates problems, interpretation that I think we're not as well-equipped to deal with. And a few years ago, Cardinal Ratzinger issued a document, Dominus Jesus, Lord Jesus, in which he affirmed a basic Christian doctrine. We are saved only through Jesus Christ. And yet that was viewed as controversial, even by some fellow Catholics who said, oh, well, this is very narrow-minded. But I think that very definitely, if you understand ecumenism in the sense that Vatican II meant it, he was an ecumenist.
One of the paradoxes I personally observe at the passing of Pope John Paul II is he pulled off something that few men of great stature really ever have. I am an amateur historian, but what I've noted is very seldom do you have a person in history who has such huge aspirations to tackle such huge problems. Maybe Abraham Lincoln might fit into this category as well. And yet, along with huge aspirations, apparently personal humility. Is that a fair assessment of the man, John Paul?
Yes, I think it is. He tended to use the word I, whereas previous popes ceremonially used the word we. And in some respects, he revealed more of himself. He allowed himself to be, photographs of his youth and that kind of thing. But I don't think he was in that egocentric. I don't think he was somebody who was, boasting. He was not someone who stood on dignity. He was rather relaxed. He could be seemingly very at ease in a way that I think a person can only be if they're not concentrating all the time on themselves. And I think he had a very, very strong sense of he had been given an enormous responsibility, and it was not him, it was God.
He visited the United States rather significantly on several occasions, but most recently in the 90s. What was the ultimate purpose of that visit? What do you think historians will say why he came to both North and South America? And was it in any way to try and deal with kind of the wandering church in North America?
The church is not wandering in North America any worse than it is in some other places. In fact, it's much worse in Western Europe. We're a little better off than they are. I don't think he went anywhere specifically for the purpose of dealing with problems. That just didn't seem to be his manner of operation. I think what he did do in his travels was he wanted to try to reach people directly. In a certain sense, if you will, speaking over the heads of their leaders, communicating with them directly, communicating over the head of the heads of the media. And he did that to some extent. And on the other hand, the format of the huge crowds and all the rest of it probably meant that the subtleties, the nuances of his message were often not clearly understood by people. And so he certainly, I think, by making himself an extremely appealing figure, and reiterating his message over and over again, he certainly gave that message a visibility and a credibility that it might not otherwise have had. I don't know myself if the effect of this, the bottom line effect of it, was entirely proportionate to the effort that was put into it.
Was this Pope anti-woman?
Well, absolutely not. The Pope has very... you might say, exalted things to say about women. He's developed what some of his supporters call a real feminism. Obviously, he viewed, for example, if feminism regards abortion as a fundamental right, he viewed that as a destruction of womanhood, as a perversion of womanhood. The key issue, of course, for Catholic feminists is the ordination of women to the priesthood. Here we get into very complex theological issues, the role of the priest as the other Christ, the whole Catholic doctrine of the Eucharist, in addition to which, of course, the tradition of the Church. But under John Paul, I'd say women rose to more positions of leadership in the church, other than the priesthood, than ever before. He seems to have been someone who got along very well with women and had a very exalted view of women, and not just the traditional idea, well, let's put them on a pedestal, but seeing them as with great talents and particular duties and responsibilities which God had entrusted them with.
We're talking with Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University. and historical perspective on Pope John Paul II, today on Issues, Etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 are our call-in numbers. Turning to the immediate future, what would history indicate if a pattern can be discerned about what is to follow and what kind of papacy will follow John Paul II?
History is full of surprises. That's one of the few laws which prevails. In some very practical terms, going back 150 years or so, the cardinals only once have elected as pope a sitting member of the papal curia. If they follow that procedure, then you have to look for a man who's the bishop of a diocese. He may have served in the papal curia, but he won't be in it right now. The big question, of course, I mean, you know, maybe all the molds are being broken. They went outside Italy for the first time in over 450 years to elect John Paul. Will they now decide to go outside Europe? If they go outside Europe, a logical place to go will be Latin America, with the largest body of Catholics in the world. There is also, of course, the Southern Hemisphere, and we're becoming increasingly aware of the vibrancy of Christianity in Africa at a time when it appears to be perhaps dying in Europe. Will that be an appropriate thing at this point? I don't see. There is also the possibility of, if we borrow a football term, punt, and that is perhaps elect an Italian bishop, an older man who is not going to have an extremely ambitious agenda, may not be pope for too many years, and then that gives everybody time to kind of reassess the situation and decide what to do. So I can see them going off really in several different directions, and I find it impossible to predict which one.
How? I mean, I know that the process can take as little as 2 weeks.
That's right. But, well, I mean, theoretically, it could take a ballot, you know.
Sure.
That rarely ever happens, but it could.
The way the process proceeds, Dr. Hitchcock, is there discussion among the cardinals there in the Sistine Chapel? Do they try and reach some kind of consensus before a vote is taken, or do they simply take kind of blind ballots?
They are forbidden by the rules to lobby, and I presume that one of the things that means is you cannot campaign for particular candidates. What they do, I imagine, but of course usually we don't know what goes on in the conclaves. What they do probably is cardinals will talk either formally or informally about what they see the needs of the church. So someone might say, we need a spiritual leader, or we need someone who is able to confront the challenge of Islam. We need someone who's concerned with social justice, whatever they might say. And then I suppose people will understand, well, this is probably a reference to Cardinal so-and-so or Cardinal so-and-so. But my understanding is they are not supposed to deal in terms of names.
As you say, it could take a single ballot. That would be, you know, by the middle of April, there might be another pope.
Right.
Of course, it also has taken months and months and years at certain times in history.
Right.
If it goes into a month or 2 months, should people read something into that as though it's impossible for them to come to a consensus, or is that just the way the process might work?
No, I would say if it goes on for more than even just a couple of days, it probably means some very sharp divisions and a very difficult time reaching a consensus. I would think that under ordinary circumstances, I forget how many ballots it was for John Paul II, but I would think under ordinary circumstances it would be resolved within a matter of a few days. Now, there's also been some changes of the rules. It's supposed to be a two-thirds majority, but the rules have been changed that the size of the majority is reduced after a period of time. So the longer the balloting goes on, if they don't get the two-thirds, then they reduce it and they reduce it some more, and I think it finally gets down, perhaps, to a simple majority.
I've asked you this before. Before the Pope died, and I'll ask you again, you successfully predicted the advent of Raymond Burke to St. Louis as the successor to Archbishop Regali. What about the next pope? Who's the most likely candidate or candidates in your mind? With 1 minute here.
What I would call the safe bet, is a man I happened to meet about a month ago, Cardinal Angelo Scola of Venice. He would be, I think, one who would not be controversial, and he would be seen as a good caretaker. A very, very bold and, I think, promising would be the African Cardinal Francis Arinze, who serves in the Curia, and that's probably a strike against him. He was supposed to be in St. Louis this week, but, of course, he's canceled his trip. I'll give you a couple of real dark horses so that if it should happen to come true, remember this.
Okay.
Cardinal Bergoglio of Buenos Aires and Cardinal Sandoval Iniguez of Guadalajara, Mexico. They probably aren't going to make it, but if they do, remember you heard it here first.
Of those men that you have named, are any of them as young as John Paul was when he was elected in the 50s or 60s?
No, I believe they're all around 70, and my guess is they will definitely want to have an older man. But on the other hand, you know, how do one plan for a short pontificate? Because with medicine today, you elect a man who's 75, he can still go for 20 years. But I don't think they're going to want to elect anybody under the age of 60. I think there's no matter how much you love the Pope and how much you admire what he does, I think there is a sense that, well, you know, after a while, a movement kind of begins to run out of gas, and we need some new blood, and I suspect that's going to be in the Cardinals' minds.
Are you at this point in right now in your career as an historian where you have that sense that many do in these days? We're always watching history in the making, of course. That's kind of mundane statement, but watching significant history be made with the death and the succession of John Paul II.
Yes, I do. I think this is a real crossroads for the church, in the sense that is this going to be, let's say, a pope who will take the intellectual and spiritual legacy of John Paul II and really try to institutionalize it? There is the possibility of what we might call a caretaker pope. That's probably an unfair term.
About 20 seconds here.
Yeah, who will, you know, not do anything, as I say, too bold or regressive. But these issues are going to have to be faced, and if they're not, if this is not the great crossroads, then there's going to have to be one in another few years.
Dr. James Hitchcock is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. and professor of history at St. Louis University. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. I'll always enjoy it.
When we come back, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn will round off our discussion today, posthumously, of Pope John Paul II with a theological perspective on this papacy. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Then we're going to continue the program, changing the subject. We'll talk about the Episcopal Church USA and the Book of Hebrews later today on Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.